Righty. Welcome to another episode of Conversations with Annie and Kate. Our guest today is Lynn Dang, and I'll throw over to Annie to introduce.
Hey, everybody. Nice to be back. It's been a little bit of a break since our last recording, and I've actually missed doing these. So welcome, Lynn, to our next episode of Conversations with Annie and Kate. It's a pleasure to have you here. Lynn and I have been friends now for a good few years. So it's always lovely to bring a friend on to have a lovely chat. And one thing that I always love about these chats as well is I know I'm going to find something out about Lynn that I don't already know. So I'm excited for this one to see and find out what that might be. So quick intro of Lynn. She's the HR director for Microsoft Singapore, works in the senior leadership team and does all the usual things that you'd expect a HR professional to do, like aligning people and culture strategy and making sure that Microsoft's vision and mission, you know, is core and part of all of that work. She does talent acquisition, retention of all that talent within the business, compensation, benefits, all those fabulous things. And then Lynn's actually been in the tech industry for over 15 years. She doesn't look it, by the way. She looks seriously still in her 20s. And she's always cared about employee experience, creating that strong sense of empowerment and belonging to organizations and helping them achieve their commercial success. So before Microsoft, she was head of talent acquisition at IBM Australia and New Zealand. And Lynn is also a former refugee, Vietnamese refugee, and grew up in her very, very early years living on a refugee camp, which has inspired her to work to ensure equality and opportunity for all those in disadvantaged groups. And that's culminated with her being a board director for Australia for UNHCR, the UN's refugee agency. And she received her Bachelor's of Commerce from the University of New South Wales. Welcome, Lynn. It's lovely to have you.
Thanks so much, Annie and Kate. It's great to be with you both. And yes, it feels like a long time, hasn't it?
Yeah, we chatted before we hit the record button how time seems to sort of lost all meaning, partially because, Lynn was saying the days all sort of feel very similar. So there's no sort of, well, Mondays I go into the office or Saturdays I take my family out for lunch or something like that. It's sort of everything's the same. So it's hard to kind of tell the difference.
Yeah. And also, you know, I think because everything's virtual now, it doesn't feel quite as real to me. I mean, it's lovely to see people, but it's not the same.
That's true. Well, I have to say, here in Singapore, we've actually had our office open and people are out and about, but obviously with masks. So the Singapore government has mandated mask wearing since March last year. So there's like it's been maybe better handled here in Singapore than many other countries. And now with like this new wave of the variant, and I feel really fortunate that here we've been out and about, but it does still feel very, I don't know, this new normal that they talk about, like it's still like, it takes time to adjust to. So it is very strange. And the fact that we haven't been able to fly back to Australia to see family, that has been a very odd thing to experience in our life. Yeah.
Before we go into a couple of quick questions and then a bit of a chat, Kate, what are you drinking?
I'm drinking gin, Bombay Sapphire, and it's preparation for writing my university assignment after this.
Well, I am on good old Yorkshire Tea Gold this time. This is the upgraded version to normal Yorkshire Tea. Can confirm it's really rather lovely. How about you, Lynn? You got a drink in your hands?
I am. I'm just about to crack it, so you might just hear it. But I'm also drinking gin. And this one I discovered, I don't know if you all have seen Fleabag, but that was my binge last year during lockdown. And you know, the very delightful Andrew Scott, hot priest in the show, connected with Fleabag over the G&T. But the Marks and Spencer's one, Annie, so you'd be proud of this because we actually...
Very proud.
Yeah, well, we live very close to a Marks and Spencer's here in Singapore. So I walked down and saw the gin and, yeah, I've been addicted since.
Love it. So first off, if you haven't seen Fleabag, folks, please watch it. It is absolutely incredibly funny and just really heartwarming and sad at the same time, but very good. Please watch it. All right. First question from me then, Lynn. What is one thing that you know now that if you could go back to yourself 15 years ago, what would you tell yourself? What piece of advice would you give?
Yeah, that's a great question, Annie. Start with the easy stuff first, right? You know, honestly, I think 15 years ago, I would have been 25 and really just like starting in the tech industry. Like you said, I turned 40 this year. So despite what Annie said at the start, I
welcome to the 40s club.
I'm looking forward to it. But yeah, 25 years ago, I think, honestly, I was still very much like finding my identity in the professional world and even the personal world, I would say. Like I spent, I think in the intro, you'd said I did start life out in a refugee camp. But I think some of the things that happened between like the refugee camp and growing up in Australia is, you know, quite different, and being poor and being a refugee and all those things, like, and still finding my place in this world. I still think in my 20s, I was still finding that, but in the professional sense. So if I could go back when I was 24, 25, I would say to myself, like, it's okay to be you. Like, it's okay to be different. There's no need to like have to hide aspects of your identity as you find yourself in the corporate world. And I think like I'm there now, but I wish that I had been there a lot earlier, just to probably all the angst around those early years of corporate life wouldn't have been so hard. But I think, and now I think about sort of the things that I'm doing at work and all that, like I really wish I could have done that even 15 years ago, like how much impact I would have had over the last 15 years. I mean, I'm very committed to spend, you know, the rest of my working life, you know, driving the change that we need in the tech industry around this. But yeah, that's what I wish I had. But then again, you know, it's a journey. So it's just one of those things where I just think, yeah, just be yourself, and it's okay to be yourself as you are. You don't need to change anything.
Yeah, it is one thing I hope changes for younger women, though, that they feel like they can be themselves much earlier than we all did.
Yeah.
We've talked a lot about this, haven't we, Kate, with some of our other guests, that there's just a point where most women hit a certain age. I think I hit it earlier than perhaps average, of just, you know, you hit the fuck it button and think, yep, I'm done now. I'm done with this. I'm not going to pretend to be anything else. I'm not going to suffer fools anymore. I'm not going to suck it up. I'm just going to call out the bullshit when I see it and be who I'm meant to be.
Yeah. But, you know, I was thinking like outside of like our own reflections about when we reach that point, I'm like, at what point will our systems and our societies also give the space for different people to just be themselves earlier, right? So there's that journey on an individual point of view. But then when you think about it, why do we feel that way? What are the structures in place that make women or women of color or just anyone who's quite different to feel like they couldn't be themselves? And I think that we need to spend
anyone who's not a white man, you mean?
Yeah, basically. But essentially, like, what are the structures that we can do collectively now, you know, for many of us who found that, what can we do instead of just, you know, asking people to have these reflections?
I've changed my default being. So whenever I talk about a being, a dog, a cat, an animal, a human being, any of those kind of things, I always default it to female now. So when I see a dog, I don't go, that's a good boy, that's a good girl. Until I know otherwise, that's a good girl. And that's my default being now, is female, because we always default to male, and why should we?
Yeah, I completely agree, Kate. And I didn't realize how pervasive it was until I had children myself. Like, I've got two girls now, they're 9 and 7. And I remember like when they were younger and just reading books, like you said, the narrative, like the default centered narrative, is always male, even if they're animals. And I'm like, it's a goddamn bunny. Why is it a he? Like, it could be a she. And so I, like you, changed. Every time we read books with the girls, we would just automatically change. And we didn't realize how bad it was until like at a young age. Like, imagine. So no wonder why we feel pressured to change, like throughout our whole lives. But yeah, but it's
precisely.
I love that, Kate.
So Kate, what's your question for Lynn?
So I'm gonna ask about self-care. So it's a two-part question. First of all, do you practice self-care? And if you do, what do you do? And if you don't, why don't you?
Well, I definitely practice self-care. And in fact, at my work, the work that we do, and Annie will know this, at Microsoft, it's so core to what we're doing now with our leaders and our HR teams around this idea of prioritizing your well-being, your mental, your emotional, your physical, all of that. And so I'm a huge advocate for it. I do it myself. So my self-care is I either go for a run, or I honestly just like anything by myself. Like when you're busy at work and with kids and family, I'm like, I actually just need time away from all of that and just do something just by myself. So I'll go for a run, or I'll meditate. Like I'm a big believer in meditating, and I learned that from a young age. So we're lucky here that we live near the beach. So I'll walk down, sit by the beach, meditate. Or sometimes it's just, you know, just Netflix binging for a while. But I definitely, and I don't ever feel guilty about it. Like I actually think people need to build this as part of, we shouldn't even call it self-care. It's just, you know, making it a daily habit and recharging. But yeah, I definitely.
Bring to me on, I agree with you on that point then on sort of, it shouldn't really be called self-care. I mean, it's important to do it. Don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to, you sort of, degrade its importance. I think it should just be, well, you exercise every other part of your body, and we recognize the concept of we need to be strong, we need to, you know, make sure our limbs are still moving so that, you know, we can keep using them into our old age. Well, why shouldn't you do that with your mind and your feelings? Because they're just as important for that strength into, you know, however long we're on this earth. So it feels strange to me. And actually, if you look back, you know, in lots of other cultures, you know, particularly in places like the Chinas and the Indias of this world, you know, this has been something that's been part of culture since, you know, it started, the importance of relaxation, meditation, expanding your mind and letting it sit by itself for a while and not always constantly peppering it.
Yeah, I agree. And you know, I was thinking, if we think about the tech industry, like remember the days when, you know, people were talking about, oh, I stayed up all night, and like the bro culture of like coding all night, and people never leaving the office or working. And I think if we think about like the pandemic, I think people are really struggling with it. I think now with employees, we often hear them say, I don't know where the boundaries of work and my personal life start, and I don't know how to create those boundaries. And I think that's really sad, because I think then it means that you're prioritizing everything else in your life, like, you know, your constant emails or your constant meetings or all these things ahead of like how you're doing as a person. And so I, you know, I often say this to our employees at every opportunity where I'm doing like all hands or speaking to people, I'm like, what, you know, just your question, okay, like what are you doing to prioritize yourself through all this? Like the one thing in times of great uncertainty is the best thing to do is invest in yourself. Like that is where you're going to find your calm and your balance. And you need to do that, because everything that we have, you know, with the constant being on all the time works against that. And how do we make ourselves, how do we build into a habit and make ourselves accountable for that?
Yeah.
Which is sad, but it's good that.
I learned that lesson about the tech bros working all night very early in my career. There was a database administrator who'd worked for 2 days straight, and they were catatonic at the desk. And they deleted the entire database. And I was just like, yeah, let's not make people work for 2 days without sleep.
Yeah.
It never ends well.
No.
So going back to your sort of part of your history then, Lynn, you, we've touched on the fact that you're a former refugee. Was there a point in your sort of your childhood where that was sort of something that was not necessarily talked about in your family, or was it always openly talked about and just always something that was, you know, that you knew about?
So we did always talk about it within our family. And the reason is when we first came to Australia, it was just natural that you would connect with other members of the Vietnamese community who were also refugees. So what I actually, it was like, that was just part of my identity. But what I do remember, and I used to ask my dad questions about the war and what it was like, life in Vietnam, because I was three at the time when we left the country on a boat, and we landed in Malaysia, but I don't remember much of life in Vietnam. Now, thankfully, I've been back to Vietnam many times since then. But I didn't remember what life was like in the fishing village that we lived in. So it was never something that we kept quiet as a family. But I do remember growing up in Australia, and this is what I sort of referred to earlier about identity. It was not something that we openly shared with other people. So I remember being at school and, you know, if people said, where did you come from? I would say Vietnam, but I wouldn't necessarily say, hey, we escaped the country, we're refugees. In fact, we lived in public housing when I was younger in Glebe, and you know, I never really shared that with even friends or family. And at the time, it was just, I think it's both internal and external. Like, you internalize, as a kid, I mean, you always sort of know where you're different and you try to fit in. And I think when you're a little skinny, introverted Vietnamese, like refugee kid, like it's like compounding on top of that. So I never really talked about any of that. But I think there's that external element. Nobody else talked about it. So there was no space for me to just show up as that person as well. And so I think it was a bit of mix of both. And then I think now, obviously, it's something I talk about a lot. And so much of that is that that intention to create space for others to talk about their experience as well, if they haven't found that yet, or just to normalize it a bit. Because I mean, I know so many refugees, actually former refugees. I mean, I know, and we have many friends in common, like, you know, Jamila, like so many wonderful people, like in the organizations that we all work with and partner with in Australia. And then I've visited refugee camps and I've met refugees now. And I just want to normalize that. It's, you know, we have 80 million displaced people globally right now. But growing up, I think it was in Australia, it was very, I don't know, it was a lot of pressure to like not be different and to not share those things. So for a really long time, I would say the first two decades of my life, I really didn't share it with other people until, yeah, I was a bit more comfortable in my mid-20s. And then that's been a journey then since.
And you mentioned you've been to a refugee camp or visited refugees. Tell us a little bit more about that. What was the experience like? Where did you go?
Yeah, sure. So I think earlier you mentioned, Annie, that I serve on the board of Australia for UNHCR, so the UNHCR is the UN Refugee Agency, and the Australia arm is just the national partner. So we do a lot of work around advocacy, the fundraising, and just elevating refugee voices in the media. And then also part of fundraising is going out to, I mean, I think it was, I can't remember which mission it was, but we had raised almost $1 million from Australian donors to set up this vocational training center in Uganda. So that's where I went in 2019, my last trip. And I'd hoped to go to another Kakuma refugee camp this year, but obviously with COVID, it's probably not going to happen. But my last trip was in 2019. And that was with a bunch of wonderful women. And Zoe Ghani was one as well, who also sits on the board with me and a friend of ours. And we went there to open this vocational training center for thousands of refugee youth in the Chakatu refugee settlement, which is in Uganda. Now, Uganda is pretty unique in the sense that it has quite a different policy in that if you cross the border into Uganda, the government automatically gives you refugee status. So there's no, you know, having to prove it. And I guess because the country is just surrounded by, South Sudan and conflicts in Burundi, and then there's the Democratic Republic of Congo. So it's just a nation that has always been a welcoming of refugees. So the policy is that when you come in, you do get a piece of land and then some training around it. But it means that the country does have over 1 million refugees, which is really intense. So we went out to, the Chakatu refugee settlement and just spoke to the youth there and opened up this vocational training center. And the center will train thousands of refugee youth over the next few years. Skills like, I think there was like baking. They were like, I immediately ran over to the, like where I could taste the food. Of course, that's the first place I went to. But yeah, there was like baking. There's a computer lab there as well. So the kids were learning computer skills. There was mechanics. There was like planting and a whole range of things. And the idea is that for most people, so I only lived in a refugee camp for 9 months, a little under a year. But now the reality for most refugees is they will spend many, many years there, if not decades, with some as well. So this idea of how do you continue your education, and in a country like Uganda, where you can actually go out to the host community and make money, you find that refugees are trying to find the skills for that. So we did that, we opened that and helped youth. And then we also connected with another group of women called the Refugee Craft Women's Group. And they're just incredible. So they started off as like five women who had lost their husbands in different wars. So some were Congolese women, some were Burundi women, some were South Sudanese women. And so when they first came to the country in Kampala, the capital of Uganda, they were like, how do we make a living to send our kids to school and all these other things? And they started a craft group. And then over time, more and more women joined the group and they learned these crafts. And so they set up this area. So Australia for UNHCR, our national director, Naomi, had said, oh, we should start like a seeding for it and give them money to start. And as part of that, they did start that and it's just grown. So we went out there to visit the refugee women, had a look at their crafts and had a look around the center and still keep in contact with a lot of them as well. So these incredible, resilient, like really funny women, like coming together and supporting each other. So no, it was a really inspiring trip, which is why I really can't wait to get myself back to another refugee camp, because I get a lot of energy from meeting refugees and a lot of inspiration and just how else we can help.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Well, one day, hopefully the vaccine and things will settle down, hopefully.
Yeah, fingers crossed, right?
One thing I want to come back to, Lynn, you mentioned when you were talking before, much earlier, that you've been meditating since you were young. Tell me about that.
So we come from a family of Buddhists. And another thing I really didn't share when I was younger, actually, was that we were Buddhists. And I think there's so much that we didn't share, but my parents are Buddhists, and so at a young age we used to have these beads, like these beaded bracelets, and you would learn how to breathe by moving through each bead. So honestly, when I was a child, I was like, this is ridiculous, but I did it anyway because it was, you know, like any learning. But I realized over time it's something around just really focusing on in the present moment, and I think a lot of that was what really helped my parents through their refugee journey of, you know, leaving their country, taking this trip. Because I was a child, I didn't realize the dangers with it, but they did that. And I realized so much of how they've lived their life is in the present. And much of that is through their religion. And so they taught me at a young age to meditate and to be mindful. And that's something that I still do now. And, you know,
That's fascinating. So what were your parents doing in Vietnam before they left?
Yeah, so my father was in the war, and so when he was away, we used to have a grocery store in Vietnam, but then after the war, all sort of like assets were seized and Dad was sent to a re-education camp, and so they were just starting life again after that, and then just odd jobs here and there. But essentially that was it. We had like a grocery store. I have three sisters. So my sisters were with us. And so Mum took care of us and Dad would work. And then after the war, he came back and went to a re-education camp. And yeah, it was.
Yeah, because no refugee leaves their country for fun. They leave it for a reason.
No.
And, you know, I'm really glad you got to Australia, but so many can't. It's really tragic. And we're so unwelcoming. I understand we've let some refugees out of detention today.
Yeah, after 8 years, wasn't
it? I know.
Yeah.
So, I mean, somebody was likening, you know, obviously we've got lots of different things to compare this to at the moment because of COVID. So you've got a bunch of tennis players who've arrived in Victoria to play in the Australian Open who are whinging that their, you know, conditions in their, you know, effectively 4 or 5 star hotel rooms aren't good enough. And then you've got other people sort of talking about, you know, the fact they have to do 14 days of quarantine when they come back to Australia now. And then you've got people who've been stuck in a hotel room who were medevaced off, you know, Manus and Nauru because they have health conditions, and then kept in a hotel room where they blacked out the windows so these people couldn't actually see the outdoors, or that other people couldn't see in and see them. And he's just like,
the world is just nuts, that we're in this position where it's okay that, you know, people without status can be just locked in a hotel room for 8 years. How does that happen?
Well, the Liberal Party's changed. You know, Malcolm Fraser opened the doors to the Vietnamese refugees, and I believe he did the right thing. And, you know, the Liberal Party has moved far right now and are very, very nasty about things now.
Yeah. I mean, you're right, Kate. It was like Fraser who opened up and did the regional solution after the Vietnam War. And that's why people like myself and my families were resettled. But then it was like the Labor governments under Keating who introduced mandatory detention. And then since then, you know, we've shifted. And I agree with you. I think it's completely unnecessary to be locking people up. And people aren't, refugees aren't political footballs. These are people's lives. But it's really sad that, you know, both parties and even just the environment that in the last, you know, 20 years or so, that we've really had less compassion for it. So I kind of actually hope that it was something that Zoe and I were talking about, because I do think that COVID maybe gave people, and again, it's, there are some similarities in the situation of, you know, being, not being able to have uncertainty about the future, to be locked in and not know what's going on. But I do think it's just a fraction of what refugees face. And I hope that we emerge with more empathy for our fellow human beings, particularly those who are really vulnerable, like refugees and displaced people. And like you say, Kate, refugees don't leave because, you know, they just want to pack up and go. Like, there's good reasons why they've been, you know, it's either wars or persecution or so many things. Nobody wants to leave their home. Like, that is a last resort for so many, but they're in danger. That's why they do it. But yes, I agree with you. I think I'm happy about the release today of the men, but I do think that we still have a long way to go.
Hopefully something interesting will happen. Perhaps not.
Celebrate the small wins.
Agreed.
The other thing that I wanted to celebrate today as well is, of course, you know, on the day of recording, we are now in a new presidential system or phase, if you like. Hooray. Hopefully good riddance to the old guy, and good luck to Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. And you know, Kamala Harris's parents were immigrants to Australia, the US. She's a woman of color. She has an Indian heritage as well as Jamaican heritage. Her parents, as I say, were immigrants. Isn't it fabulous to see a leader stand up and break that glass ceiling for us?
Yeah, nah, I think it was on Instagram that I saw all the photos of like children watching her the inauguration this morning. I thought, what a great moment. But you know, I also think of like what pressure on the vice president at the moment. And I really wish it, like she said, she's not going to be the last, and I hope it means that we have more people like Harris or the Jacinda Ardern's of the world, so that we don't have to rattle off the list of like the only five that we know, that I think, you know, we're moving in the right direction. But actually, I'm very impatient. I hope for like change at a much faster pace when we think about world leaders or where we have powerful positions and how we get women of colour in, or women in general as well.
Well, that leads me to an interesting question, because a lot of the time we say that you can't be what you don't see. So now, you know, millions of girls are seeing a woman of colour as a vice president, which is a good thing. You know, how in tech, you know, we've got more women in leadership than we've had ever before. Not that that's too many. You know, is representation where we want it to be yet?
Hell no. What do you think, Eddie? I think hell no. Not even close.
God knows, I end up at meetings where I'm the only female in the room. Still.
Gosh, that still happens, Kate? Wow.
Especially in cyber. In a lot of cyber meetings, you know, it often happens. But so what are some of the techniques that you're using to improve representation of diverse people in tech? Yeah,
it's a great question, Kate. And I agree with you. Like, I think that, representation is so important, right? Like millions of people are inspired. And I think about, like, if I go back to my story, like, why did I not share these things about myself? Because I just didn't see myself represented. I didn't see it in pop culture. I didn't see it in, you know, TV. I didn't see it in the media. I didn't see it anywhere. Like, and I still don't really see that much in Australia, to be honest. I still think Australia has a long way to go around representation in mainstream media. But there's a lot of stuff that we are doing here at Microsoft and in the tech industry, but I still think we're still such a long way to go, and it shouldn't just be each company. We have to think as an industry how we're thinking around it. I'm quite lucky that in my role in HR, there's a lot of things that I do, like, can ask those questions and have control over, whether it's our hiring practices. So here at Microsoft, we talk about having a screening mindset and thinking about, like, if we go back to, I remember when I first started in the recruitment team, like, many years ago, this was at IBM as well. And, you know, all the things that we know now, like job ads, are just written to, like, screen people out. You list all the technical requirements. And for what reason? And now we often say to our managers, like, why are you listing it down? Describe to me the person or the team that you're thinking, that you're building. And I can tell you it's not going to be all these technical skills which can be bought. And referrals, I actually think referrals in the tech industry is not a great thing when if it's not diverse where you're hiring from, because people refer the same things, the same privileges they have. So where they went to school, who they know, all these things that, you know, people of diverse backgrounds don't have just yet. Like when I think I was growing up, like my dad was a baker and my mum was at home looking, like I had no connections in the tech industry or even the professional world. So just rebuilding that. And so just being aware of that and knowing that some of these things we don't.
So why did you get into tech?
Yeah, I often ask myself that question. And you know, my first job in tech was like really funny, but like at our financial institutions, a lot of our customers, like Westpac and NAB and MLC, I was like their tech support. So if the server went down at like 2 a.m., I would get the call on the beeper and like run over to like the server room and reboot like their server. That was like my first job, which I loved. I think I really love technology, Kate, just to answer your question a bit more seriously. I think when I was younger, like I really understood computers. I remember even being in, I went to Tempe Primary School, and like even like at 10, I was like the tech help. They knew to call me if the computer in the went down. So I don't know what it was. It just, I really, like, I understood both hardware and software. And so that's at a young age, I enjoyed that. And then my sister, my older sister, she did a Infosys degree at the University of New South Wales. And so I would go with her. I was 16 at the time, but I would just go to lectures with her. And so I just learned a bit more about, you know.
Snuck into a lecture.
Yeah.
That's hilarious.
Yes. Yeah. And then so when I went to, I did a commerce degree, but when I was looking for a grad position, I knew it was going to be in the tech industry. And so over time I started technical, but now as I move into more leadership roles, it's trying to find roles where I can have greater impact about representation in our industry and looking at some of our diversity inclusion initiatives and thinking about how we can create this impact at scale with our leaders and our employees around how they think about diversity and inclusion. And really one of the things I really absolutely hate about how we've positioned diversity in the tech industry is how it's like a, you know, a feel good initiative that every company
nice to have on the side. It's a bolt-on. It's not part of the core system.
Exactly. And also how we position as if we're helping these communities or these people. And I'm like, no, at the end of the day, if we want to be the most successful in the company or industry around innovation, around, you know, even business results, financial results, we need diverse people to come into our industry and to challenge us and to be part of the voices in that room where we're creating the products or services or talking about our customers. We need them, not they need us, or, you know, the way that we position it. So yeah. I think that's wrong. Like, it needs to be a proper business scorecard proposition that we're talking about.
An argument for me on that.
Yeah, the amount of times that I have to, you know, sort of, and I'm not going to lie, I still have to check it myself as well. The, you know, are we doing this to make ourselves feel better or just tick the box, or is this actually going to move the dial for a diverse founder or a diverse group? And if it's not doing the latter, then it doesn't matter how good it makes us feel or whether it looks great, you know, on paper or it's a lovely marketing exercise. If it doesn't actually help the people that we're trying to support, enable, empower, then frankly, we should just get out of their damn way.
Yeah, agreed.
Mm. So Lynn, when you moved recently to Singapore, we've talked a little bit about that. What's that been like for you, sort of leaving a, you know, sort of a very, I think, you know, you've been in Australia for obviously a very long time, but, you know, so you've got friends and family and a whole network around you, and now you've moved to Singapore and you've moved your whole family there. What's that whole experience been like?
Yeah, and during a pandemic year as well. So we've been here just a little under a year now. And I remember us actually just flying out to the airport, and Patrick, my partner, and I were just looking at each other going, something is strange. Like, it's very quiet here. There's hardly anyone on this flight to Singapore. We just heard about COVID, the coronavirus at the time, but obviously not to the extent that we would have by February and March when the lockdowns, the first wave of lockdowns happened. But yeah, it's been really interesting. So like you said, Addie, I'm very close to my family, as you can imagine, like growing up, my three sisters and mum and dad, really close, and our girls have been very close to them. So it was a tough decision. I know when I spoke to my parents about it, they were supportive. I think it was a career move for us, and it was also a move for me career-wise. My partner is a wonderful house husband here, so he does all the stuff with the kids, like takes them to school, does all the cooking and stuff so that I can focus on work. And that was when we moved, that was how we thought about it as a family unit. But I think for us, the main thing with the move, both my career and just for us to be in a different country, for the girls to really get a bit of change and adapt to that, because they've always had good strong family support around. At the time when I made the move, I won't lie, I really thought that we would be flying back every 2 months at least to like see family. It's like we could take a red eye flight and be in, you know, Sydney in the morning. So that obviously has not happened. And so thank God for like technology to really keep in contact with family and friends. But I have to say, Addie, it's just been, honestly, I've never worked through a pandemic before and have to look after like all our employees in the country and be part of the crisis management team and work with our leaders and back to our US teams on this and learn from our China teams at the very start. So work has kept me incredibly busy. The food here is amazing. So
I love the food in Singapore.
Well, Kate knows I'm a huge foodie here. So yeah, the food has been amazing for us. And we've really bonded as a family of four here. And we've built our networks out here with friends and colleagues. And Singapore's not a tough country to
be. It's not
a nice place to stay.
The reason why I asked the question though, Lynn, is, you know, there are so many women who don't get the opportunity or don't take the opportunity to prioritize their careers and their, you know, sort of opportunities, and you have, and I think that's an incredible example of, you know, as a family unit, and that your partner Patrick has taken the decision to be the stay-at-home dad for a little while. It's like, we need more examples like that to show other women that you can prioritize your choices first. You don't have to be
you've got to choose a good partner first. Woman's choice of partner is so critical to the rest of her life, not just for her love life, but for her family, for everything. Obviously, you chose a good one.
Honestly, that was one of, you'll laugh, Kate, but I had like a mentor when I was younger in my 20s, and she was she's an MD of a tech company now, but she said to me, pick wisely. And at the time I wasn't dating anyone or one of, and she said, pick wisely, because if you're serious about your career, you're going to need to choose someone who will support that and lean in on the home front. And she's a mother of four. So, yep. And she knew that I wanted children as well. And that was part of sort of the plans that I wanted. And I have to say that I agree with you, Kate. Like, we talk about women, I actually don't like the lean in movement. We talk about women leaning in at work, and I'm like, we actually need to talk about men leaning in at home or partners leaning in at home, just as much, if not more, because I agree with you. Like, you have to make sure you can prioritize. I agree, Annie, definitely women, go out and prioritize your career, prioritize what you want to do in life, because that, to be the best version of myself as a mother, I need to show like my girls that I'm okay with making decisions where I can put myself, you know, not just first, but as a family unit as well. So I don't have to prioritize myself last, but you know, it's one of those things that I think when I first became a mother, I fell into that trap of thinking, you know, I have to take care of the kids. I have to think about all these things. And it took a few short months to like get over that and say, hang on a minute, crazy, you know, hormonal mother, breastfeeding mother at the moment, like rethink that, because at the end of the day, you know, you want to be the best version of yourself. And this is how you're going to teach your girls how they can also prioritize themselves in a world that may not always tell them that.
Yeah. And to be able to build a genuine partnership, which is, I think, you know, the goal that many of us want, where everybody is sharing in the load, and different people prioritize their career at different times. And, you know, that's kind of the ideal. So it's really great to hear that you've been able to do that.
He's a good one, and he loves to cook. So I'm a terrible cook. I cannot cook at all. So he finds it relaxing, which is like very strange to me. Nothing stresses me out more than cooking. Handling a global pandemic and crisis management meetings every day, that's fine. But sort out dinner, gosh, that's stressful.
I know. I've had friends who've done those cooking at home on Zoom, where they deliver a pack to you and you cook in a Zoom session, and they've all found it terribly stressful and very unpleasant. But you can do anything via Zoom now, apparently.
There you go.
Like a podcast.
Anyway, that's probably a really good place to draw it to a close. Thank you so much, Lynn. Lovely to see you. Lovely to see you too, Annie. Hoping we can get you home in the not too distant future.
Fingers crossed.
Thanks so much, Kate. Thanks, Annie. Take care.
Love you, Lynn.
Bye.